And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved. To feel myself beloved on the earth. Raymond Carver says most of what there is to say. Because what do any of us want at the pinnacle of our soul's greatest yearnings but to be beloved? Perhaps on some important levels we do want other things. We could make quite a list of that which we struggle mightily for. We want to be successful. We want to be impressive. We want to avoid failure and pain and loss, but most of that eventually points around to the true north of our soul's yearnings, the magnetic pull up from deep within us, tugging us onward toward our great need to be loved. To be loved, in the end, by God, by the One, by anyone really, or perhaps by everyone. And to love in return, again, to love God, to love that one special person, or if you are great enough, to love everyone. To be loved is to be known, seen, understood as a part of a blessed whole, and it is, I think, the guiding force behind our human quest for fulfillment. Underneath the pride, the ambition, the fear of failure lays this great hope that we might be loved, to be beloved upon this earth, Raymond Carver says in that poem. And this is, in the end, what too many of us spend the vast majority of our lives thinking is beyond our reach. This week, I've been thinking a lot about those among us who have lost loved ones. Our members who have lost so much are hurting in ways words can't describe. They are faithfully putting one foot in front of the other, and in every case, they are filled with an aching, tender love for the ones they have lost. In spite of everything, an aching, tender love. And I know that loss is at least at first sad. I know that it is achingly, searingly sad. I know, but there is something about the love these people carry, remembering the ones they've lost. There's something about the love they carry that makes me truly know that things are all right with the world. Because each of those lives, the lives of those who have died this week and this summer, each of those lives was a glowing success upon this earth, in that each and every one of those persons was so deeply beloved by those who mourn them. No matter what those people may have done or not done, no matter what successes they may have or not have felt, they were glowingly, screamingly successful at life because they were beloved. And we feel it now. Those who mourn feel it now. What might be, after all, the whole point of living, to love and be beloved, was carried out to its fullest in the lives of these persons, and so I am grateful and I am happy for them. Each of these dearly departed, that they were and are loved so deeply, and I hope the same for us all. Not only so that someone might miss us when we're gone, because that's a little too easy, but that the love we knew and the love we gave might have changed lives even just a little bit. When in pulpy novels, and usually in the pulpit, people talk about love, it's often the romantic variety that comes up first. Soulmates and forever and valentines and cupids, arrows and all of that jazz. But love and being beloved, even by one's soulmate, is a matter so profound that it transcends all of our definitions and all of our categories. It goes beyond even our fantasies of what it's supposed to be beloved on this earth. Is not contingent on any one kind of relationship, but on a way of being in which you are willing to both love and to be loved, and to take on all the risks involved in it. In our reading today, John Tagliabue painted a picture for us of bare branches yearning to reach out, to bridge the distance so that finally, after so long, they might touch and be touched, making all of the cold space between them, between us, nothing at all. That reading is a poem about the great yearning that we feel, that we can't wholly escape, even when we are surrounded by our own dear friends. And love, the thing that connects us, that crosses the gulf and stretches over chasms, is not usually the kind they advertise on soap operas and blockbuster movies. It's bigger than that, and more universal and pervasive. Love, the thing we crave, it doesn't have to come from a Valentine card. It comes in different, deeper ways, ones we may not notice if we aren't paying attention. Frederick Buechner, great, great preacher, wrote about the different kinds of love that the Greeks defined for us. You know, there's brotherly love, there's romantic love, there's love that embraces all. And in his writing, he said this: the first stage is to believe that there is only one kind of love. The middle stage is to believe that there are many kinds of loves, and the Greeks had names for all of them. The last stage, the ultimate one, is to believe once again that there is only one kind of love. The unabashed eros of lovers, the sympathetic philia of friends, agape giving itself freely, no less for the murderer than for the victim, these are all varied manifestations of a single reality. There is love among partners, and there's love among friends. There's the love of a father who holds his daughter in his arms, and the love you feel when a car drives by on 66 with the soapy letters written, "just married," and you hope with all your heart that those people you may never meet and will never know have more days of joy than of suffering. All those things are love. The same darn thing, all those things in different forms, but fundamentally united. Love of neighbor, of self, of the whole blessed universe. This is what we crave. What bare branches reach out for against the wind. What this sanctuary and this community we create within it promises, even in bumbling little ways. I honestly cannot remember if the love story that I'm going to tell you today is a love story I've already preached. Sometimes I find that my internal monologue and the dialogue we share in worship get sort of muddled in my head, and I can't remember if I just thought about something a whole lot or I preached it to you. In any case, there's a story that I want to tell about love and about its universality, about the crying out for connection that we all do, and like bare branches of trees, we sometimes stand alone, yearning to bridge that gulf and not knowing how. The story I have to tell is by J.D. Salinger. It's a story some of you probably read in your high school English classes, perhaps begrudgingly, from his 1961 book, Franny and Zoe. If you know it, bear with me. If you don't, hear me out. I've got background info before I make my point, so don't let me lose you here. Here, if you will allow me to attempt it, is the plot of a great novel in four paragraphs. Franny, a central character in the book, is a college girl from a brilliant, if depressive, family who's got everything going for her. She's lovely, she's smart, she's got awesome clothes, and an Ivy League pedigree, and a charming boyfriend with really great hair. And she's the loneliest woman in the world. She sees through the polished facade of her promising life and past the slick pressed collar and glossy hair of her perfect boyfriend, past the meaningless symbolic acts of football games and grade getting and dancing the newest steps and smiling for the camera, and she wonders if any of it at all is really connected to anything deeper than that glossy, smeary surface. And this girl, with everything going for her, this lovely, lonely girl who doesn't know if anything is real and if love even exists, she takes to her bed. In a state of classic literary existential crisis, she lays down and refuses to get up, dwelling always on the question of whether there is meaning, if life is anything at all but the pasted on and manufactured image of something. And she cries, and she doesn't eat, and she sits alone, because at least that loneliness feels honest, more honest than being around people who are fake. And so goes the book. It's good, and it's really sad right up to the end. When Franny, the existential mess, the teenager in meltdown, has a conversation on the phone with her brother Zoe. Zoe is an actor, equally promising, equally smart, almost as tortured as his sister. And they are remembering together in this conversation they have their older, wiser, even more tragic brother, Seymour. They are remembering what he told them. Zoe talks in the paragraphs I'm going to read about acting on a radio program and thinking it probably doesn't matter either, since the whole mess is meaningless. This was something that the children shared, and they were kind of prodigies of a sort. And she speaks in these paragraphs about the efforts she made to muster courage and to care. With my few edits for the very saltiest language that Salinger offers, Salinger himself can take it from here as Zoe tells his story. I started complaining one night before the broadcast. Seymour told me to shine my shoes just as I was going out the door, and I was furious. The studio audience were all morons. The announcer was a moron. The sponsors were morons. And I just damn well wasn't going to shine my shoes for them, I told Seymour. I said they couldn't see them anyway where we sat. He said to shine them anyway. He said to shine them for the fat lady. I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but he had a very Seymour look about his face, and so I did it. He never did tell me who the fat lady was, but I shined my shoes for that fat lady every time I ever went on the air again. All those years we were on that program, if you remember, and I don't think I missed it but a couple of times. This terribly, terribly clear picture of the fat lady formed in my mind. I had her sitting on a porch all day, swatting flies with her radio going full blast from morning till night. I figured the heat was terrible, and she probably had cancer, and I don't know. Anyway, it seemed entirely clear why Seymour wanted me to shine my shoes. It made sense. Franny had taken the phone away from her face and held it with two hands. He told me too, she said into the phone. He told me to be funny for the fat lady. What? Yes, yes, yes. All right, let me tell you something now, buddy. Are you listening? Franny, looking extremely tense, nodded. I'm going to tell you a terrible secret. Are you listening to me? There isn't anyone out there who isn't Seymour's fat lady. That includes your professor and cousins by the dozens. There isn't anyone anywhere that isn't Seymour's fat lady. Don't you know that? Don't you know the secret yet? And listen to me, don't you know who the fat lady is? Ah, buddy, it's Christ himself. Christ himself, buddy. And on the last page of the book, Franny goes to sleep. First real sleep she's had in a long time, a dreamless and peaceful sleep. She sleeps with a smile on her face, just knowing, really knowing, deep in her bones, that as long as you can muster the courage to care about her, this one random woman sitting on a porch alone swatting flies in the afternoon sun, as long as you can care about her, or really about anyone at all, take your pick. the whole earth is crammed once again with meaning, and all of it, the mess and glory of it, matter again. I read this novel and reread it when I need to as a love story. It's a love story between a person and the whole world, between a single lonely girl and the great teeming mass of humanity with which she shares this precious planet, to shine your shoes for some lady you've never met and will never meet, to do your very best in this life because she, this beloved stranger, might just be listening, is to put everything we do in the context of our interconnection. In place of all of our judgments and our petty complaints, we have what one might call universal love. "Don't you see who the fat lady is?" Zoe asks. "Ah, buddy, it's Christ himself. Christ himself, buddy." That line tells us that this lady on her porch is as worthy of love and devotion as Christ himself ever could have been. Even the professor you hate, even those myriad people jamming the beltway, and that woman you've loved all your life who sits across the dining room table every night and can't seem to stop disagreeing with you, all of them, every one of them, is as worthy of love and devotion as the Savior herself. "Don't you see," the characters ask, "the terrible secret that we are called to love it all, them all, those we know and do not know, those we like and do not like, all of them, to love them all. This is universalism. Pick anybody. Pick Jesus. Pick Confucius. Pick Seymour's fat lady or the person next to you in the pew or the guy who sold you your coffee this morning. Any one of them, every one of them, is as worthy of devotion, so worthy that you might change your whole life just to make theirs better. You see their flaws, their hopeless failures, their veiny legs and sweating brows, and you love them anyway. You love them. You are your very best for them. You lessen the distance between us all by knowing, really knowing, that every single person, even the most obnoxious one, is part of a universal love that they might choose to ignore, but you cannot any longer choose to deny. Every person is as worthy of love as Christ himself ever could have been, with the potential to be as holy as a saint, even in their pockmarked messiness, even with their horrendous crimes, even if you must do everything possible to protect yourself from them, even with their false starts and their faked apologies, every one of them still, in spite of it all, is so sacred that it stills your breath. That's the implication of universal love. That's the terrible, marvelous, challenging truth of universalism. It is a terrible, marvelous, challenging truth that some days I'm ready to live out, and some days I would really rather avoid. Universal love is no easy thing. As it is written about in mid-century novels and ancient holy books alike, it is a swirling, swimming mass of feeling that connects each to all and never leaves us alone, never leaves us bare branches against the night, shivering in our isolation. Because we're all in this together, buddy, and the sacred dwells within each of us. And the love we feel for others is, if offered freely, extended back and back and back again until we know ourselves to be beloved on this earth, as worthy of love as the fat lady and every Messiah who ever lived and all those who are yet to come. We are Seymour's fat lady, every one of us. Not only are we called to love her and care about her enough to change our lives for her, but we are also conversely called to see that others might feel the same for us. Others might reach across the channels of our separation and see us as holy, as worthy, as beloved upon this earth, no matter what. Do you see, buddy, the marvelous truth that you are as sacred as the Christ child? Do you see that in spite of it all, even if you never ever notice, someone might be shining their shoes just for you. May it be so. It's an amen.